Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the murder of Irina Zarutska on Charlotte's Blue Line is mentioned in Donald Trump's State of the Union address this week, leading him to muse,
what's going on with Charlotte?
As Charlotte City Council members ponder a pause in carrying out plans for the I-77 toll lanes, questions linger about transparency. Meanwhile, council is working on next year's budget priorities, and with public safety as a key focus, get ready to open your wallets.
We might be facing a situation that we have to increase taxes.
January snowfall is leading to rising energy bills, and Waymo's self-driving taxis will soon be on our streets. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News climate reporter Zachary Turner. He's here with Ben Thompson, an anchor at WCNC-TV. Ashley Fahey is managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, and Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Morning, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Mike.
Morning.
Morning. So Tuesday night, we witnessed the longest State of the Union address in history, peppered, as has become the norm, with introductions of people in the gallery.
We are honored to be joined tonight by a woman who's been through hell, Anya Zarutska.
She is the mother of Irina Zarutska, whose murder on the Blue Line last August grabbed international headlines.
In 2022, she and her beautiful daughter, so beautiful, what a beautiful young woman, Irina fled war-torn Ukraine to live with relatives near Charlotte, North Carolina. And by the way, what's going on with Charlotte?
So Trump riffs on all of the speeches that he makes. Was that an ad lib or is that in the printed copy of the speech? Does anybody know?
I believe that was an ad lib, and I know we'll talk about it as well, but the part that a lot of people seized on was when he alleged that DeCarlos Brown came through on open borders or through open borders. That also was an ad lib.
Okay, well, that's where I'm going next, because he went on, as he did a number of times in that speech, to outline in graphic detail Irina Zarutska's murder, and he made this observation.
She had escaped a brutal war only to be slain by a hardened criminal, set free to kill in America, came in through open borders.
So that statement, as with many others in that address, is only partially true. First and foremost, DeCarlos Brown did not come through open borders, as you alluded to, Joe. He's an American citizen. And I guess the question is, can he be accurately described as a hardened criminal? What was his record prior to his alleged murder of Ms. Zarutska?
I mean, he's been arrested 12, 14 times. He has a conviction of armed robbery or robbery for dangerous weapon. I think hardened criminal is a fair assessment of DeCarlos Brown. In terms of crossing the border, he did not. He is an American citizen. The other person who is accused of stabbing someone on the light rail from Charlotte, Oscar Solorzano, he did illegally cross the border. So I don't know if Trump was confusing the two or if he saw DeCarlos and made an improper connection, but there are different factors at play there.
And of course, Donald Trump made this promise to Irina Zarutska's mother.
Mrs. Zarutska, tonight I promise you we will ensure justice for your magnificent daughter, Irina.
So, Ben, this was a local murder, but because it was committed on public transit, there is a federal component to this crime. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I mean, the Federal Transit Agency and Department of Transportation has talked about possible punitive results that could come if Charlotte doesn't sort of get its act together, if city leaders don't take this more seriously. So, I mean, there certainly is a federal component to this. I think there's an important case to be made about what happened to her and what caused it. And I think people got upset because it muddies the water of what already is a serious standalone issue. When you say he came across because of open borders, that's a completely different issue. The part that ARENA addresses is completely separate and should be addressed separately because it's a different problem. I think that's why people got sort of upset about it.
Yeah. Has Donald Trump or has the Justice Department spoken about what action they might take should they choose to prosecute this murder at the federal level? Do they have they talked about what the penalty might be or what the criteria would be for them to make that decision?
The charge that he's facing at the federal level does have the ability to receive the death penalty. They haven't talked about what they may seek in terms of punishment. I also think that there is a long way to go before we get to that stage, because I was in court with him when he had his federal court hearing. It was like the first time he's been seen in public since the crime, and he was out of it. I mean, it didn't look like he knew what was going on. So there's also going to be a mental health barrier as well that prosecutors are going to have to overcome in order to get a prosecution.
As we have been increasingly witnessing over the years in our ever-increasing hyper-polarized political environment, Republicans stood for almost everything the president said, and then the Democrats sat in their seats for much of it, including a gotcha moment, which has gone viral. They did not stand for this promise to help Irina Zarutska get justice. Is that going to bite them?
I don't think so. I mean, this is, as you alluded to, this is quite common. I mean, Joe Wilson from South Carolina yelled at Barack Obama, "You lie." You know, these are the most partisan of our partisan politics. These speeches are, and that was on full display that night when Joe Biden was president or Barack Obama was president. Republicans didn't stand either. So this is not really the best of our political system on display. It is the most partisan, pettiest version of our political system on display. And I think most people who follow politics know that.
Joe.
Yeah, I mean, President Biden did the same thing. He puts lines in there trying to, you know, get people to stand that maybe don't typically stand for his speeches. So, you know, in every State of the Union address, there are lines like that. I think reasonable people, though, are disappointed that a moment honoring Anya Zarutska was not more well received, or there was not more bipartisan support honoring her as she cried her eyes out when Trump brought up this heinous murder. And she is not a political person. I know she was at the State of the Union, but she is not out doing interviews every day on cable networks or with local media. She has stayed behind the scenes. She has talked to Democrat and Republican lawmakers. She, from everything I've been told, the Zarutska family is incredibly private. So, you know, overall, I don't think anybody will be talking about this in 9 months. But in that moment, I understand why people were disappointed there wasn't more support for the family.
Irina Zarutska's murder, of course, got national and international attention. And Republicans were quick to blame Democrats for that crime, as the president alluded to at the State of the Union. In North Carolina, her murder was fuel for the creation of Irina's Law by the General Assembly, which restricts cashless bail, something that Donald Trump mentioned in his address, and revived the state's dormant death penalty. And it has become an issue in the race for U.S. Senate. The primary to select the candidates from both parties, by the way, is Tuesday. Early voting ends on Saturday. And Michael Whatley, the Republican candidate, along with state Republicans, are doing their best to place the blame for this murder on their presumptive challenger in the November election, former Governor Roy Cooper, the Democrat. So what are they alleging, Joe, that Roy Cooper did?
So there are some general things in terms of cashless bail, being in support of policies that make it easier for people to bond out of jail. And then there is the presence of DeCarlos Brown on this COVID-19 settlement list that the Department of Corrections says that, yes, he was on the list, but he wasn't released because he was on it. But he was on that list. And so that is a tie to Roy Cooper, even if it didn't necessarily have that impact. But those are the two main fragments of this argument that we will hear over the next couple of months from the Whatley campaign.
And as you reported this week, Michael Whatley's campaign produced a digital ad addressing this very quickly after the State of the Union message, in which he shows something that Zarutska's family has asked not to be shown. Describe those moments. They're pretty graphic.
Yeah, and this goes back to what I was just saying about Zarutska's family being private. Yeah, after this horrible crime happened, her family asked, like, hey, can you please not share this video? Please don't post this video. It's awful. It's literally our daughter getting murdered. Her brother and sister keep accidentally seeing it online. Please do not share this video. Honor her memory other ways. And so it was a surprise to me to see that Michael Whatley created not only a digital act using footage, not just her sitting on the train, but you see DeCarlos Brown standing up, making the stabbing motion. You see her looking up into his eyes, horrified. And then at the end of the ad, you see her slumping over just in one of her final moments. So it is incredibly graphic. It would be disturbing to anyone who saw it. So I asked, you know, why are you producing an ad with this graphic imagery when the Zarutska family said, please don't?
And here's what Michael Whatley told you.
You know, what happened to Arena is barbaric. And her family has, you know, my and my entire team's utmost sympathies. And I want them to know, you know, I'm running to make sure that no other family has to endure this kind of a horrific tragedy.
And this will be part of his campaign. And he point, and I guess on both sides, because the Democrats will have to rebut this. But he pointed out to you that despite the family requesting that the video of her murder not be shown, and in fact, they have requested that it not, they've requested ordinary people who have seen this online not to post or repost it on social media. He says it was released by the city of Charlotte.
Anytime you have, you know, an event like this murder that is so catalytic in terms of a conversation, you know, that people will use the pictures, you know, as part of this conversation.
Is that really justification, or is everything now fair in politics?
I think that, you know, norms of politics from 20 years ago are not the same norms of today. I would just say, though, that everyone is familiar with Arena Zarutska in North Carolina and her story. I don't know if it's necessary to show her
right,
just about to be stabbed and slumping over. I think that you can accomplish whatever message you want to say about Roy Cooper by just showing her picture or showing crime scene tape or, you know, just showing her sitting on the train. I don't think people need to see a murder on television or the internet to feel something in 2026.
And I know, Joe, that you cannot speak for Channel 9, and Ben, you cannot speak for WCNC-TV, but all stations and broadcast facilities have standards and practices. This was a digital ad, which I assume means it aired on the internet. Would a television station have accepted this ad and aired it on their airwaves?
There are two very, very different standards by what airs on a broadcast station, specifically not even a cable station, but a broadcast station, right, versus what airs on cable or what airs online. I mean, his campaign can put this just online on their website, and it could be nothing more than that, versus what we face because of our FCC license is a far higher threshold before it can air.
You want to echo those comments, Joe?
I of course cannot speak for Channel 9.
Right.
There is, I think that during silly season, when it comes to political ads, news stations in general have a set of standards that they make sure that their ads reach. And certainly if you won't see it on the television news, there's a good chance you wouldn't see it in a television ad. But I'm not speaking for Channel 9. That's up to my bosses.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about the I-77 situation, because they're still pondering what to do about those toll lanes that are scheduled to go in between Uptown and the South Carolina line. And we will also take a look at some courthouse arrests that took place this week outside the courthouse by ICE and what's going on there. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Zachary Turner, WFAE's climate reporter. Joe Bruno reports for WSOC-TV. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. And Ashley Fay is managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. We've been talking about in the last few weeks these proposed toll lanes on I-77 from Uptown to the state line. And we've been talking about it for a couple of weeks because some neighborhoods on the west side are critical of the plan that's been suggested by NCDOT, that the lanes be elevated above the current existing highway. And on Monday, nine Charlotte City Council members said they want to pause planning. Ashley, is this a reversal in course for these members?
Right. So Charlotte City Council cannot unilaterally stop or change the project timing or really any aspect of it. That power lies with Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization. I think it's important to note that Charlotte City Council, as a through a representative, does hold a good chunk of the votes of that board, about 40%. But what's currently being considered is, will City Council vote to request their representative, which is Councilmember Ed Driggs, to go to that board and request a pause in the project. Then that organization has to vote on it. So it is not something the city can unilaterally decide on its own, even if the majority of council is in support of pausing it. But they certainly could wield their political influence to try to bring that to the organization.
You sound very definitive on that. At the meeting, Mayor Lyles and the city attorney didn't know that they could do that. They seemed a little confused about whether or not they had the power to do that. And you're saying that they can't. Why don't they know that?
I don't know that I could answer that if someone else wants to take that. But that's okay. Just how the structure is from what I understand.
Joe?
I mean, there's back in 2015, 2016, they went through this with the North. And that was when the Lake Norman communities were pushing for the project to be canceled. And they directed their Charlotte representative to hold the line and basically keep the project. So they have a lot of sway. I guess if they're confused on whether they can do it, it might be whether CARTPO, CRTPO will put it on the agenda, whether they can force an item to be on the agenda. But they can certainly direct their CRTPO representative to vote however they wish to.
Ben.
It's also an issue, realistically, of the dog catching the car. If this happens and they stop it, well, then what? I mean, you know, we're still going to have massive traffic problem. We're still going to have, you know, 100,000, 160,000 people along that stretch of road every single day. And then what? I mean, so I do think it's important for them to press pause for 2 months. But bringing it all to a complete end, I don't think the business community wants that. I don't think a lot of folks, commuters in Charlotte want that. I think press pause for maybe a compromise of some sort. Yeah. Sure. A full stop, I don't think, is going to be in a lot of people's best interest.
And a lot of the pushback, all of the pushback is coming from West Side neighborhoods. McCrory Heights President Sean Langley explained at that meeting on Monday what his group wanted.
Our ask tonight is very simple. Pause the project. Let's have meaningful community engagement, but our ask tonight is to pause this project.
So NCDOT has been working on this for months. They've been holding meetings with area residents for months. The options appear to have been widen the highway, make it wider, because you got to squeeze those lanes in somehow. And if you do that, you have to take real estate from the west side of the highway, because the east side of the highway is uptown. You can't take any land from that area. And the other option is to elevate this highway. But some of these residents say they were misled by both the city and the Department of Transportation. How so?
Well, I think, I mean, I know speaking to, you just heard from folks in McCrory Heights, I know from speaking to them exhaustively about this, is that they thought there might be an option to bury these lanes. Turns out that is not an option. That's not feasible. It'd be billions of dollars that the state, the city do not have. And so I think neighbors specifically in McCrory Heights that could stand to lose a few houses if the interstate was widened, I think they had it in the mind that they were being brought in early in the process and that they would actually have not a choice of two bad options as they see it, but a choice of many options. And they'd be along for the entire way. I think they feel like they've been brought on at the very last second with horrible options. And you talk to people there, and this is not just personal, but this is generational. I mean, I know talking to neighbors in McCrory Heights, they remember in the 60s seeing houses moved up to Hyde Park in North Charlotte. I had one guy tell me one time, McCrory Heights was home to the best cul-de-sac in the city of Charlotte. But once the Brookshire came through, it is no more. And you have a lot of families there. I mean, keep in mind, you've got people in McCrory Heights who are in their 90s who remember this. And the scars are still serious.
Yeah. Ashley and Joe want to comment on this. Ashley, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to something Sean Langley has brought up in conversations I've had with him is, you know, this is a long-term project. Why do we need to rush to lock something in right now? Like, why can't we take our time with it? Especially since the initial plan was publicly presented only a few months ago. I think a lot of folks in the West Side just maybe feel like the rug has been pulled out from under them. They want more time to talk with NCDOT. I know a lot of them are just advocating to kill the project, which to Ben's point earlier, probably isn't going to happen, but I think a lot of them are just feeling like this is all happening without their input. They want more time, and this is what they're largely advocating for.
Joe.
A couple issues here. The maps, the design was not presented until after this project was pretty much a done deal. It might have been a done deal at that point, depending on when that RFQ was issued. So people, you know, these designs, Steve's done amazing reporting on this, as he always does, about how, you know, they had these preliminary designs, they weren't shown. Maybe we're not in as much of a fiery situation now where it feels like our backs are against the wall had they been shown a little sooner. So that is one of the issues. There are certainly still a lot of scars from the I-77 North project. Those prices are astronomical. And people are seeing them and wondering what's in it for them. And then you also just have this really interesting time where the city has received more than $1 million and is putting a lot of time and effort into studying how to best reconnect the West Side while also pursuing a project that will further encroach into the West Side area. So there's just a lot going on here. I think city council once again fell for the trap of doing something, not following up on it, not getting any updates on it, and then having it fall back into their lap with the room on fire. So they didn't get as many updates as they probably should have. And as a result, now everything is a mess.
I mean, if you look up the definition of being between a rock and a hard place in the dictionary, this is going to be the example that they use because there really are no good options here. You either widen the highway or you elevate the highway. Is there another one? I know you can't bury the highway. The State Department says we can't afford to do the big dig like they did in Boston here. So is there another option?
Well, so here's maybe this hasn't been communicated well enough, but like the private company in this is going to have to submit design options. So maybe one of these four private companies that are in contention or, you know, that were suggested for the RF through the RFQ process will have a creative solution for what to do in the McCrory Heights, Wilmore, Uptown area. And, you know, the other thing that really they're trying to get out there is that this project, they're trying to learn from the northern part. They're going to have a toll cap. They're going to put in a discount for low-income users. There's still going to be the HOV lanes. They're trying to add more community benefits than maybe the northern section of the tolls have. But if I worked for NCDOT or if I was a city council member, I would also be trying to dig in more on what these private companies can offer the McCrory Heights residents. I don't know. Maybe they can bury a certain, maybe Cintra comes back and says, we can bury this one little part of Uptown. I don't know if that's feasible for one of these four companies, but it's out there still.
Ben.
So the expanded interstate, the widened interstate, that definitely takes out homes and takes out homes in McCrory Heights and Wilmore and part of Fraser Park. The elevated does not necessarily. And so speaking to neighbors, I said, okay, well, what's wrong with that then? It's elevated. People don't lose their homes. And they very correctly point out, who wants a double-decker interstate in their backyard? Nobody. And you can't fault them for that. I mean, these are people who enjoy living there in their neighborhoods. As I alluded, some have been there for decades. But nobody, whether you're new, whether you're been there forever, nobody wants that. The fumes, the gases, the eyesore. Because neighborhoods are not the same after an interstate goes through like that. And they know that firsthand.
Ashley wants to comment. So does Zachary. Ashley, go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of this just comes down to quality of life. Basically, it says, well, you may not be destroying my homes, but car emissions, the sound barrier, there's questions about how would you mitigate the sound from the vehicles on the highway nearby if it's right up on your neighborhood, even if you don't demolish homes. So I think a lot of this, too, is just the quality of life and how is NCDOT going to mitigate that, which I don't know if the West Side has gotten answers on that.
And Zach, you're the climate and environmental reporter here. There is an environmental component to this, quite clearly.
Yeah, I do. I remember talking to residents there on the historic West End and Macquarie Heights about these problems, but relating to Brookshire Freeway. They're really getting it on both sides. They've been trying to get a sound barrier there on Brookshire Freeway, get some separation between them and this road for a long time. They're also facing bad stormwater issues. I spoke to a resident that's kind of like right in that nook between these two highways, and she experiences frequent flooding, terrible mosquito issues, and it's just been a nightmare of communication. I think that's been sort of the big through line here, is there just has not been good communication between the residents of Macquarie Heights and the folks working on these interstate projects.
And the Charlotte City Council has now decided to make these lanes the centerpiece of their upcoming retreat next week. And it should be pointed out that the full council has not discussed this project since October of 2024. Yikes. Okay, on Tuesday, four people were arrested and taken into custody by ICE at the Mecklenburg County Courthouse. Each of the four was at the courthouse for previously scheduled hearings. Is this another instance, Joe, of ICE lying in wait to pick up people who are trying to comply with the law, or is there more to it than that?
So what's interesting is I didn't notice detainers on any of the four people's court records. So I don't know if this was a situation where, like, maybe many years before online records existed in Mecklenburg County, that they had detainers or what. But for whatever reason, these four people were on the radar of ICE. And back when Joe Biden was president, there was a directive in place that said we don't target sensitive areas like courthouses. And that was rescinded. So now we're seeing, not just in Mecklenburg County, but across the country, ICE agents do go to the courthouse and pick up suspects either before or after their cases because they know they'll be there.
And that brings this up. The ACLU of North Carolina has filed a lawsuit against what just happened at the courthouse. Their legal director, Christy Gronke, explained their intentions this way to WFAE.
We are asking the court to do what many courts around the country have done, which is say that ICE cannot behave this way, that CBP cannot behave this way, that the Department of Homeland Security has to follow its own rules and regulations.
But last year, the Department of Homeland Security issued guidance saying that ICE agents can conduct civil immigration enforcement in or near courthouses when they have credible information that leads them to believe their targeted suspects will be present. Is that what we're looking at this time?
It is. And the Mecklenburg County Sheriff has crafted a deal with ICE to basically says that, hey, ICE, whenever you want to come and make an arrest in my courthouse, give me a heads up and let me know so I can make sure our deputies are aware and they can help out with any issues. And from what I understand, that has been happening. And the partnership between ICE and the Mecklenburg County Sheriff in terms of this has been well. It's worked out for Mecklenburg County. Now, it got a little hazy this past week when attorneys for some of these suspects were, ICE claims they were interfering. There was certainly a back and forth engagement between them, and the deputies had to get involved.
Well, WFAE reported that according to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office, one attorney questioned ICE agents about whether they had a warrant, while the other two attorneys stood near an elevator inside the building. Would those actions make them subject to arrest?
I don't. What are you doing near the elevator? Are you blocking them from getting on? Are you standing holding the button? Are you blocking the person from, are you standing in between ICE and the suspect when you're demanding a warrant? I don't know. Unless I'm in the room, I can't really referee about whether somebody is potentially breaking the law.
Okay. Well, aside from dealing with the toll lanes at their upcoming retreat that Charlotte City Council will be holding, I think, beginning March 1st, they focused on other issues this week. On Monday afternoon, they held a budget workshop to explore priorities for next year's budget, which is likely to focus on public safety. Council's Dante Anderson made this observation, one that no one wants to hear, that increasing public safety will likely come at a cost.
We might be facing a situation that we have to increase taxes to double down on public safety as it relates to CMPD, as well as our fire sworn fire officers.
So, Ashley, sales taxes are going up, I think, in June, the end of June, because of the referendum for transit. How was the mention of higher taxes on top of that received by members of council?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky thing. Obviously, the council is still early in its budget workshop and budget planning. So, like, a lot still to be determined about what that actually looks like in reality. But, you know, I think the lever of property taxes is something that, you know, we should pay attention to, especially as home values have risen so much in Charlotte. There's a lot of questions about, is there more that could be recouped from that? And I know I listened to Estella Patterson, of course, the new police chief, talk about the officer shortage last week. And she's estimating that there's over 200 unfilled positions right now. And it's been really hard to retain and recruit officers from CMPD, mostly on the pay side of things. So that's been a tricky kind of balance, I think, that the city council is considering.
And that fact is something that Councilwoman Dimple Ajmera finds concerning.
As the chief said at the hearing, that we are falling behind when we compare our city to other neighboring towns and municipalities.
But that uptick in vacancies is from 8.6 to 9%. That's 0.4%. How serious is that?
Well, I will also note that the police chief said last week that the city is currently authorized to have about, I think it was 1,936 officers, and so we're short on that number. But she thinks the city of this size and growing as fast as Charlotte needs about 2,100 officers. So obviously that isn't a huge increase as far as the vacancy, but in Patterson's mind, as she has said publicly, there's actually probably a need for even more authorized officers than what the city is currently authorized for.
I have 20 seconds. I don't know how big Minneapolis is, but it appears to me to be as big as Charlotte, or maybe bigger than Charlotte. They only have 800 officers.
I can't speak to that.
Okay. When we come back, it's too darn cold. When we come back, we'll speak about firefighter pay, among other things, and rising energy costs for you. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Zach Turner, who's our climate reporter for WFAE News. Ashley Fahey is managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSSC-TV, and Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. So not only do we have these vacancies on the police department that the police chief finds concerning, evidently we're also falling behind in the fire department. When it comes to compensation for firefighters, Ben, WCNC says current compensation is not keeping pace with the demands of the job or with the city's growth. What does pay have to do with growth?
Well, I mean, you're talking about, you know, CMPD needing more officers. The fire department, for as long as I can remember, I said, hey, we don't have enough firefighters. We've got to find a way to lure people in to do this job. It's been a problem for years. So what they're wanting right now is say, hey, bring us up on par with police officers. Starting salary right now is about $3,000 more for police officers. Firefighters start at $56,000. Police officers start at $59,000. They're saying, hey, at least bring us up to that pace to make it more equitable between cities, police, and firefighters.
Yeah, they want a cost of living adjustment, and they want to have equal pay with the police department. What is the difference in pay between the two organizations?
It's about $3,000 starting pay. Once you get beyond that, it gets more nuanced. But I mean, yeah, I looked into it this morning, and that puts us sort of in the middle of the pack. I don't have numbers for Minneapolis. However, I can tell you that it does put us in the middle of the pack for other peer cities like Nashville, Indianapolis, Columbus, some a little bit higher, some a little bit lower.
But clearly, you must have the numbers for St. Paul, right?
Of course.
Evidently, along with the police needing extra officers, firefighters are also facing vacancies in their ranks. Mark Wilson is the secretary of the Charlotte Firefighters Association.
Firefighters from all experience groups, those with a couple years of experience and those with 20 years of experience, they are leaving to go to other departments and other fields of work that offer better pay and benefits.
And again, the possibility of raising taxes came up in this discussion. Councilman Malcolm Graham mentioned the city has not raised taxes in the past 2 years and has done so only once in the last 7 years. So where would you place the possibility of a hike in city taxes on a sliding scale between likely or inevitable?
I would say likely, but a couple things to keep in mind. Yes, the city hasn't raised taxes in 7 years. The county has. We approved a bond for CMS. That's resulting in tax increases as well. And revaluation has happened, I think, 2 times in that 7-year cycle, maybe one. And that's changed people's tax bills as well. So people of Charlotte still have been feeling pain just because the city of Charlotte hasn't raised property taxes. And also keep in mind, this year is going to be a big year in the state legislature in terms of property tax reform. And they haven't really started talking about it yet, but there is a trend now at the state level, not just in North Carolina and other states, to look at property taxes and what relief they can provide residents. So we'll see what this looks like in the spring.
Okay. We're going to see what our energy bills look like right now. We can't wait for spring. January was cold. We had 2 consecutive weekend storms. The first one brought ice. The second one brought almost a foot of snow. And now people are getting their power bills, Zach.
Yeah.
Is sticker shock the words we're looking for here?
I think that's a word for it, but Mike, it's kind of a range, I would say. For some people, they're noticing barely anything. I know for my studio apartment, not a huge change. But for folks that are living in some of these older homes, older apartments with less weatherization, we're seeing folks with $300, $400 bills for heating. And that's left a lot of people wondering kind of what happened.
I mean, you reported that somebody has a bill of over $650, which evidently is more than they are accustomed to paying, although they claim not to have changed their thermostat. So is this just because it got so cold that the heat never stopped running, or were there significant rate increases either at Duke Energy or at Piedmont Natural Gas?
Yeah, a lot of people were curious, what happened with rates? And there was a slight increase for Duke Energy Carolina's customers in January, about 3.94%.
But that sounds like a lot. Is that a lot?
3.94%. So say you usually have a bill of $150, that's probably $4 to $6 difference. That's not going to get you up to a $400 heating bill. Where this is coming from, and it's going to depend house to house. If you live in an older house, if you have poor insulation, you're just not going to be using energy as efficiently. It's going to depend on what sort of heating apparatus you have, if you're using natural gas, if you have a heat pump. But what it comes down to basically is how efficiently is your home using energy, and then how much energy is your home using. And a lot of homes just have to work harder to make up for that big difference in temperature.
And of course, when the cost of energy goes up for heating bills and the like, that hits the people who can least afford it the hardest. Carol Hardison is the CEO of Crisis Assistance Ministry, and she says that with the Duke Energy rate increase and the fact that area residents used about 15% more energy to heat their homes in January than they did in December, the pain is real.
It's unbelievable. You'll see someone in a couple-bedroom apartment, and it will be $300 or $400.
So Crisis Assistance Ministry offers financial assistance to those struggling with utility bills. Are they being swamped with requests?
Yeah, they definitely are. I mean, I think they'll see over 100 people in a day, and so they can't necessarily, with the funding that they have, they're not able to help everybody. They have to do a little bit of triage here. So they're mainly there for people that are on the brink of disconnection, and that's something that we're starting to see more and more year after year in these last few years.
So help me understand this, because natural gas has been described as a bridge fuel between coal and clean energy. Mm-hmm. It's cheap. It has been traditionally inexpensive. I believe I'm accurate when I say that Piedmont Natural Gas actually had a recent rate decrease, but I read this morning that the price of natural gas has been rising. So what's the story? Has it gone up? Has it gone down? Why? We're fracking. We're drill baby drilling. So why?
So I think that confusion right there is really the crux of the issue, especially for like environmental advocates. This has been, and for consumer advocates, this has been a big sticking point, is that it's a volatile, when it comes to the price of natural gas, it's extremely volatile. And that's what we saw back in 2022 with that big winter storm. We got hit by a big supply crunch. We had the war in Ukraine that was impacting natural gas supply.
We don't get any natural gas from Ukraine. Do we export it?
I don't know the exact supply chain sort of.
So it's a world commodity situation, is what you're telling me. The price goes up in one place, it's going to go up everywhere.
Yeah, there was definitely a big sort of crunch in terms of trying to shore up that supply of natural gas. And I think one of the factors was that war in Ukraine.
Okay. So you also report that these higher energy bills is pushing electric utility customers to the brink of disconnection. How many people are facing that possibility?
Yeah, so I'm still waiting to get the numbers for this month, but based on disconnection notices, we're already up 10% from last year, last January. And based on the fact that we had this massive winter storm, I talked to a lot of residents that have started getting these disconnection notices. It looks like we're going to be facing, and I can pull up the numbers here, but it's going to be... I'm trying to find the exact kind of figure here, but it looks like we could be looking at a sharp increase starting this month and going into March. That's where we're going to really see a lot of people start getting disconnected.
In fact, Duke Energy reports that the number of January disconnection notices has grown year over year, and it's outpacing the growth of their customer base. What does that tell us?
So I did a little bit of digging into this past week because that was really interesting. You see the number of people that are behind on their payments hasn't changed. I mean, it's roughly 1/5 of their customer base in Duke Energy, Carolinas. What is changing is that we had people that were being phased out of these pandemic era disconnection moratoriums and put on these payment plans. And then a lot of people just aren't able to keep up with the payment plans, so they get kicked off of those, and they get behind on their bills, and that leads to these disconnections. It's folks that are getting hit by life events like car accidents or a surgery that they weren't planning for, and that just, they get behind on their bills, and one thing leads to another. You get a big storm, and you get that disconnection notice.
And again, Carol Hardison with the Crisis Assistance Ministries is worried that there could be a lot of electricity disconnections coming as higher than normal power bills arrive.
The ones from this January will just be huge, that, and that'll show up this month's bill, February, but it will be late in March. It'll be a disconnect in April.
And even as rate increases and greater usage of energy is pushing bills higher, the North Carolina Court of Appeals has ruled that Duke Energy customers will not see refunds from a mistake that the Utilities Commission made in 2024 when they allowed Duke to raise rates based on fuel costs from 2022. This is Byzantine. Explain it.
This is a tough one to dig into. Basically, we had a judge rule last week that state regulators erroneously allowed Duke Energy to, what you would say, true up a true up. The way that Duke Energy structures its rate, it's a bit of an estimated guessing game. They make a projection on what they think fuel costs are going to be, and then every year they kind of look back, they make an adjustment, and they keep going from there. Back in 2022, we had that big winter storm. It caused their fuel cost estimate to be off by nearly $1 billion. And so they came to an agreement with state regulators to extend the period of time where they would be recovering those costs from ratepayers, so it wasn't one big bill out at one time. But under the current law, at the time, Duke Energy only had one shot at this. So they had this extended period to recover those costs. Their estimate was a little bit off. And so state regulators allowed them to try and true up and try and collect that cost again. At the same time, it's worth pointing out that DEP customers, Duke Energy Progress customers, were getting a refund. So they were actually getting money erroneously back from Duke Energy.
So if Duke was mistakenly allowed to charge ratepayers for unrecovered fuel costs to the tune of $998 million, and since normally a refund to customers would be deemed an appropriate remedy, why isn't it this time?
So that's a good, I'm glad you bring this up. So that $998 million, that's the amount that they were off in the initial sum, but the amount that they actually were kind of state regulators let them illegally collect, it was $19 million. It was significantly less. You know, they were, but the reason why they're not going to be processing a refund this time actually has to do with a law that was passed last year, Senate Bill 266, in addition to doing a bunch of other stuff like eliminating our 2030 climate target. It also changed the way Duke's ability to recover these fuel costs, and they can go back as far as they need to so that they can do what they've always set out to do, which is just pass along fuel costs to customers. They're not making any money off of these fuel costs, but they're just passing that cost straight on to customers. This just allows them to look a little bit further back. And so the judge ruled that at the time they made a mistake, state regulators made a mistake. But now with the current law, they can't really do anything about it.
So before we run out of time, we have one more Duke Energy story. The U.S. Department of Energy has selected Duke to receive funding for one of Donald Trump's pet projects, a big, beautiful, clean coal initiative. What will this funding do?
Yeah, so this is going to allow them to cover the cost of upkeeping and doing some upgrades at the Bowes Creek steam station. And this is going to, this is all kind of part of their plan as they're trying to extend the life of this, coal and natural gas plant. Originally they were going to go till the mid 2030s, but they are seeking permission from state regulators to extend the life of that plant to 2040 while they're trying to get new natural gas plants and new nuclear reactors online.
Okay. Well, as we go back to the 19th century with power generation, let's go to the 22nd century with Waymo. We about to see Waymos on the street here in Charlotte. We don't have any at the moment, but Waymo has been operating in several cities around the country, including Atlanta, and recently began testing in Nashville, and they're coming. So, Joe, what has their track record for safety been in those other cities so far?
Some people love them, and sometimes with these autonomous vehicles, there are issues where things happen that might not happen had there been somebody behind the wheel. Right now, Waymos are on the streets of Charlotte with drivers behind them getting ready, and I can report that one has already been involved in a crash.
With the driver?
With the driver, yeah, it was the other driver's fault. And that happened the day the Waymos were launched. So,
and just to be clear, the drivers are going to drive these around so they can teach the Waymo driverless cars how to navigate the streets of Charlotte. And the driver made a mistake. So has the car learned from this?
I think the cars are going to learn very quickly about the special characteristics of Charlotte drivers.
So, God help them. So, Jennifer Liu told WSOC-TV that she saw these cars in operation when she was in San Francisco.
We saw them in San Francisco last year. That's pretty cool. I see people get on, get out, and see the car knows the traffic lights.
Even if they sometimes don't stop for buses, school buses. But Yolanda Watts was more cautious about these vehicles.
It's kind of scary. I mean, you know, with technology, you never know when something might go wrong.
So as they train these cars, when will they go driverless in Charlotte?
I think that's still a question. We've heard, not directly from Waymo, that they need to drive every Charlotte street at least three times with humans behind the wheel before they're considered ready to be fully autonomous. The testing process could take as long as a year. Again, we've heard through the grapevine, so we'll see.
Meanwhile, something is happening with the Charlotte Hornets. They keep winning. And on Tuesday night, they beat Chicago 131-99, setting a franchise record for their eighth straight victory on the road. Sports analysts have characterized this recent surge as one of the most dramatic midseason turnarounds in the NBA, driven by a combination of elite offense, a maturing young core, and a newfound road toughness. The Hornets' Con Knipple is receiving national attention for his historic rookie season. Commentators call him a culture-shifting presence whose confidence has elevated the entire roster. They praise LaMelo Ball. Their next game is on the road tonight against the Indiana Pacers. Go Hornets. All right, Ashley Fay with the Charlotte Ledger, Joe Bruno with WSOC-TV, Ben Thompson with WCNC-TV, and Zach Turner, our own climate reporter at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.